The Secret Life of a Data File, delivered by Decibel Music Systems. We're going to deliver a talk in three parts, I believe. So here's the first one. Evan Stein, Decibel, please.
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
you're
on a mouse. You're in
standard. Oh, I'm on a mouse. Okay.
Keys.
Keys. Okay. Okay, that's good. So yeah, just to give some insight, we're working with the British Library on this project, and wanted to talk about sort of the day-to-day stuff that we do, and sort of a little bit about us, and this is a life in search. This is not my personal life. This is my professional life. It's about searching, and basically, I'm going to talk about the company. Mark Wainwright is going to talk about some of the technical improvements that we've made recently. Georgiana Bogdan is going to talk about data collection. So here goes. Decibel is a fact-based metadata system. So, very similar in a lot of ways to Music Brains, Gracenote. There are other sorts of companies like, for instance, the Echo Nest is much more about recommendation and sound analysis. Other companies do social graph. This is based on fact, and originally it was to avoid infringing other people's copyrights, but once you get the facts together, it becomes very, very interesting because they all add up. So, if you have the same person, so we were talking about before the artist ID, if you know it's the same artist, then you can go over the artist's repertoire or what they played. So it's all very coordinated, you can link it very nicely. And so we do a lot of semantical stuff, helps us with things like language translation, globalization, very, very interesting. And it was intended, actually, originally as a replacement for the record notes, because the CDs are going away. You have nothing physical to hold on to, no booklet to read. So what do you get when you have a file? And the answer at the time was nothing. And originally it was about getting the facts so that you could approximate some sort of sleeve notes or booklet or something like that. But it turns out that if you have it in that fashion, it's actually better than the original because a machine can navigate. So all kinds of things are possible. Searching is possible. New products are possible. And so the other thing is we deliver through an API because, frankly, we don't know what's coming next. Things are still in a state of flux, and we want to be part of just about everything. And then, the bottom is insane level of detail. We collect just about everything. And when you have just about everything, you can get from one place to another, to another, to another. So all kinds of products actually are possible. Okay, so, this is one piece of software that was done with Decibel, and you see all the participants, and we get like all kinds of crazy things, like Jarvis Cocker's hairdresser is on there because you don't know. I mean, the hairdresser could be somebody else who does something else. You only know in the end. So you're collecting the information in the beginning, and these pieces of information all add up. Okay, so this has actually had its genesis, in a library. I used to work at the Library of Congress. I started life as a musician and got very, very interested in sort of classification of music, did studies in musicology, and then had an IT career. It all started one fine day when I couldn't get the printer to print in Portuguese, and it opened up a whole new world for me because you had to backspace the printer in those days and put the tilde over the O or the A, which wasn't part of the original IBM character set. I just went on, got into intelligence gathering, which was very, very interesting for search work. I can't tell you about it, otherwise I'd have to kill you. And then took my work into finance. So, each of these steps was an eye-opener in how to use computers to search for things. So, for instance, in the library, You know, we had these very, very rigid sort of classifications at the time, but it was a very one-to-one system. You would classify things for retrieval, and the way that they would bridge it was there was the resident person who knew everything. My boss knew absolutely everything, could just put his fingers through a bunch of file cards and find the one that was misfiled. Absolutely amazing. You know, the problem is when somebody like that retires, then if you don't have anybody else who can do that, you're in trouble. So, you know, there's a benefit in having the computer do as much of the work as possible. Musicology was a lot broader, you know, works and instruments and classifications and von Hornbostel and all kinds of characters like that. And then, you know, the field that I was in, which was ethnomusicology, you know, different ways of thinking about music, social sciences, and thinking about other art forms and aesthetical philosophy and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff, which gives you, you know, many, many, many different and extra ways of thinking about music and, more importantly, finding the music. Law enforcement, this was a life and a half. This was really interesting because people would come in with unstructured questions and want unstructured information to come back. So somebody would say, I want to know about the number 87. And you'd say, well, why? And they said, I can't tell you. It's a secret. But, you know, tell me what you find. So it was about linking up, you know, one mobster to another, to another, to a conversation, to a wiretap, to a license plate, and things like this. And it was hugely interesting. These were the people, by the way, if anybody's seen the television program Law and Order, these were the actual real people who did this. You know, they were somewhat less polished than the people on the television program. But it was really interesting. You know, there were no hyperlinks in those days, but everybody was still six handshakes apart. And, you know, very, very, very interesting programming. And finally, working in finance, you had these multinational companies, and you wanted people to cooperate. And everybody speaks their own language, everybody has their own currency, everybody has their own workflow. So, you know, if you say net profit, well, you know, in the UK, it's really easy because you can list your assets and talk about things like that. In Germany, you get taxed on your assets, so you have to put them in other categories. And so to get apples to match up with other apples, you would have to do a lot of very interesting programming. So, you know, putting this all together, this is actually how Decibel came about, where, you know, again, we have many, many ways of getting from one place to another, you know, different routes that you can take to find music and identify it. And the other thing that's interesting is, you know, this last slide about, you know, normalization. Because we're semantical, because we're looking at different ways that people do things, a composer can have three different names, or, you know, musicians always have aliases. People have languages, and, you know, after a day at work speaking English, they get a headache and they want their entertainment in their own language. And so, you know, we have one database that everybody shares. Everybody looks at it from their own point of view. And so, you know, this poor guy in Japan who couldn't, you know, he would buy the album if he could only read the label, all of a sudden, you know, is able to do that. So it's quite nice. And, you know, we do all kinds of crazy things, like, for instance, localized MP3 files, where, again, you can get your entertainment in your own language. So we deliver the metadata in different ways, depending on the use that people have for it. So, you know, here we are at the British Library, and, you know, we're trying to deliver this. You know, you don't know what the question is, you know, just like with the police, you don't know what the question is until people ask it. So it's a very loosely structured system. Normally people gather very stringent requirements and they only give you know, they only do the things that the users have asked for. We don't really know our users. We don't know what they're going to ask, so we give them absolutely everything. But people can follow their own train of thought, whatever that is. And the machine navigates collections. Now, the British Library has a huge collection of things, but because of digital files, we all have large collections of things at this point. So one of the big questions of the day is, how do you navigate a large collection? Spotify has a large collection. It's a streaming service. The British Library has a large collection. I've got a large collection in my house. And you know, sometimes I'm very interested in a single performer. Sometimes I'm interested in something else. You can do this. And again, you know, the difference between these large collections is kind of blurred. Everybody potentially has a library at home. So, you know, this is the end game, you know, this whole room fitting on a disc. It's possible if you ignore things like the physical artifact. But, you know, for most people, extracting the information off of something is good enough. And they don't tend to go back to the primary sources. The best way to preserve something is to keep it from dying, and if people can access the music and they're still listening, that's the best possible scenario. It doesn't need to be resurrected. It's good enough for most uses, and it can be consumed just about anywhere, which is kind of nice. You know, it's a rights question whether people can listen to digital music files off the premises, but you know, that's to be worked out. And you know, there's always something to be said about a physical record or a physical book. You know, I like those myself. I've got a room full of them. I've digitized everything at home and can't bring myself to get rid of the originals. So anyway, I'm going to hand over to Mark Wainwright, who's going to talk about our new graph database.
Thanks, Evan. Hi, I'm Mark Wainwright. I'm a developer for Decibel. I'm going to talk about asking a lot. I'm going to talk about databases today. We've heard a lot today about the importance of extracting all the data and all the metadata from everything. What we haven't talked about is how we're going to store that data and what we can do with it. And when I think about databases, I think about what sort of questions can you ask the database and expect to get answers for? And when you're trying to build the best possible database, how many questions, how can I get as many possible answers as possible? I'm going to try not to be too technical and blow your minds. Yes. So the main thing I'm going to talk about is the difference between relational databases and graph databases. And when we were designing Decibel, we decided to use a graph database, and I'm going to explain why that was. So a relational database is the alternative, and it's most databases are relational. And they're just normal. You store database in a table, and everything of the same type is grouped together. And you can have relationships. They're sort of treated as data, and you can't do certain things with them that you would expect to be able to do and you want to do. Graph databases sort of look at it from the other angle and focus on the relationships. They get special treatment, and you can do all sorts of clever things with them, which help a lot with music data. Also, the data types are very flexible, which I'm going to go on and talk about. And the way that the data is ordered is different, which also helps. And I'm going to talk about these three things in more detail. So what features of the graph database I'm going to talk about? The first is polymorphism. And this is, you can have one object with more than one type. And I'm going to go through some examples of that and explain why this helps performance a lot when dealing with music metadata. The second thing I'm going to talk about is recursive relationships. And having recursive relationships allows you to handle hierarchical data, which there's a lot of in music, and it lets you get more complete answers for your queries, which is cool. And the final thing is that the actual structure of the database, this associative structure, it lets you ask lots of questions that you wouldn't be able to ask otherwise. Anyway, I'm going to go on and talk about polymorphism. So if you're designing a music database, you might start, you would have, you know, album, artist, track, and that works. And then if you want a little bit more detail, you have to start adding things in between. So what you might do, the first thing you might do is you say, okay, I'm going to have an album, and it's going to have discs. And some albums might have more than one disc. But actually, the majority of albums are just going to be one disc. So when you upgrade your database to include discs as well as albums, you have to double up everything in it. Suddenly, all these single disc albums are an album and they're a disc, and you have twice as many things, and it takes a lot longer to search through them. So in Decibel, because we have this graph database, which supports things being more than one type, we can say that for most albums that are one disc, they are the album and the disc. And this goes even further when we start in Decibel, we talk about sides as well as discs. So an LP has two different sides, and we treat the sides differently. And that's great, because you can ask questions like, I like these two songs. Is there any LP I can buy that has both songs on the same side? And Decibel will tell you that if you really want to know. And so they suddenly have three objects or three different types, and they're all treated, they all exist on the same object at once, which helps performance a lot, and it lets you have this level of detail without affecting the performance. So that's polymorphism. The next thing I'm going to talk about is recursive relationships. This is the Ring cycle. It's a cycle of operas. There are four different operas. Each has different acts. Within those acts, there are different scenes, different movements, different arias. And you know, the question is, how do I treat this kind of thing in a database? I want to ask questions. I want to say, find me every recording of The Ride of the Valkyries, which is one of the, it's the opening number of one of the acts in one of the operas. And if you did this on a relational database, your relational database would either have to support this whole structure of cycles of operas, operas within cycles, acts, and it would have to support that for everything. So your 3-minute bubblegum pop songs would have to fit into this structure. And not many people are going to do that, and it's going to affect your performance badly. But in Decibel, we just say, all these things, they're musical works. And they can have musical works that are sections of them, and those sections can have subsections. Subsections can have their own subsections all the way down as far as you need to go. And then when you do a search for the Ride of the Valkyries, it looks for just, you know, recordings of the Ride of the Valkyries. And then it goes a step up, looks for recordings of, you know, the act that contains the Ride of the Valkyries. You step up, looks for recordings of the whole opera, and so on. And you get all of those recordings. And you wouldn't get all of those results if you had another type of database that didn't support these hierarchical relationships. And it turns out in music, there are lots of hierarchical relationships, things like instruments, we have relationships for, we have bands, locations, genres, and all of that. And with all that, we can have this really fine level of detail while still getting really complete results. So that's hierarchical relationships. The next thing is, what am I talking about? Oh yeah, the structure. I imagine you wake up one day and you really want to find all the tracks that are sung by a man who's married to a woman who wrote the song that the track is a recording of. How do you do that? Well, I did it on Wednesday, and I found all of them, because Decibel supports that. And that's because of the structure of the database and the way that it's laid out. We had a relational database once, and you could never have done this. It would have taken 10,000 years to run the query. And the reason for this is how the things are laid out. In a relational database, things are grouped together by the type. So you have all the people in a big list in some order, and then next to them you have all the works, and then all the relationships, and then all the tracks, and then all the participations. And that works very well for some things, but for music data, it doesn't work very well. And the graph way, you have a person, and then he's next to his marriage, and the marriage is next to the other person in the marriage, which is next to, you know, the song she's written, which is next to the track that's a recording of the song, and so on. And then when you do your search, instead of making these huge jumps, and you have to make thousands and thousands of these if you want to search for every single track that fits this exact pattern you're looking for, instead of having to make these huge leaps every time, you have much shorter distance, which means your pattern matching takes a lot less time, which means you can actually get results of this query in, you know, in your lifetime. So just the very structure of our database and the way that it's stored on the disks means that all these really really interesting queries that you might want to do are suddenly possible. And it's great. It's really fun. So those are the three things I've talked about. I've talked about polymorphism, how by having objects be more than one type, we can improve our performance significantly while still maintaining the detail. How the recursive relationships allow us to have hierarchies within our data, which are really good for music and it lets you get really complete detailed results. And then finally, the associative structure, which gives us lets us run really interesting queries against the database and ask a lot of it. I'm going to hand over to Georgiana, who is going to talk about her role as a data detective. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Georgiana, and my job title at Decibel is data detective. What that means is basically that I talk to the clients, I find out what they want, what they need. Then I work with the technical team. I also coordinate the research team we have and the editorial team. And I have to handle a solved case, so I strive to fit in the line of those famous detectives right there. Why do we collect metadata? So basically, the music industry has innovated and transformed itself considerably over the last 10, 15 years. It has been the engine of the digital sphere, a real technology driver, helping device innovation and connectivity, driving online search and social networking. Digital platforms and services are constantly improving in quality and consumer experience, like the British Library proved as well through their new project. And they're trying to engage an ever-growing global audience in digital music consumption. In 2012, digital music revenues have taken over physical ones for the first time. And as you can see in these stats that I took from the recent IFPI report released this week, digital music consumption is growing each year. There are about 37 million songs now available on digital services, and as you saw in the bragging slides of the British Library and the National Library of Norway, there is more and more digital content. This means that digitization left us navigating through a huge number of recordings. Digital content can be difficult to organize and use, especially because it is prone to constant changes in technology. Metadata is, in fact, a technical solution to this technical problem generated by the leap to digital consumption. Metadata can and should ensure that no matter the format, we can keep track of the music recorded over time and enjoy as much of it as possible. We collect metadata because few things matter more for the long-term accessibility of music. It is crucial for many stakeholders. So for artists, if they collect proper metadata during the recording process, this will allow them to get discovered, get their music discovered in the future and also monetized. From a music listener's perspective, they can discover music and navigate easily through metadata, and also they can enjoy a more immersive music experience. From the point of view of music providers, metadata can facilitate navigation. They can deliver to the users what music they want and in a simple way as possible. They can enhance music discovery and as a result, of course, music sales. And from the copyright holder's point of view, it's important to have recordings associated with correct metadata so they know where to distribute the revenues. And this also gives them more faith if the metadata is correct. They'll have faith in licensing more and more content to digital services. And of course, from the music libraries and archives point of view, music metadata allows for the preservation of this intangible format we're dealing with nowadays. At the scale of the music consumption, the only way we can help all those stakeholders I mentioned is to establish and maintain a comprehensive data structure and enrich and standardize metadata. Who do we collect metadata for? As a metadata provider, we strive to make our product useful for as many institutions as possible, for as many players as possible. So basically, we deliver to music streaming services, to music distributors, digital music stores, record labels, online radio services, app developers, copyright collection societies, and other players. For instance, we had a karaoke company interested in our services because they wanted to deliver their customers a better experience. What type of metadata do we collect? So we have a very comprehensive data model because we want to serve all those players. And we store the data in a graph database, as Mark pointed out, and we deliver it through an API. We have rich data fields, and we have a mix of internet sources, research that we conduct ourselves, and editorial content. So we have original biographies, we're now in the process of doing album reviews, and we're looking at playlisting and more editorial content. These are some of the data fields we provide. So on an artist level, we have the biography, biographical details like nationality and place and date of birth, and also the relationships between artists that Mark is particularly interested in. So you have marriages and brothers and sisters and all those things. On an album level, we have the copyright information, the cover art, the record label that released the album, more basic information like track count and duration. This was the album level. And on the track level, we go in more depth. So we have ISRCs, we have individual performances, so we would know who was the producer of the track, who played guitar. And then we also have venues as well, so we would know when the recording session took place and where. And we have writers and publishers and the copyright information at the track level as well. How do we collect metadata? So we use online legal sources and the magic touch of our computer programmers. We focus heavily on curating these sources. So we look with a critical eye on what we get. One of our competitive advantages is actually the way we process the data. It's not so much about the source, but it's about what we do with it. We also have quite a big research team that I coordinate. So I try to find people interested in music. Then we do training sessions with them, so we all have the same kind of frame of mind when we think of metadata and the way we collect it. And then we also have the editorial team I mentioned that writes original content. So we do need the right people as well, not only the machines. And then we also sometimes strike data partnerships with some of our clients or other industry stakeholders. How do we keep our metadata evolving? We try to keep an eye on emerging music markets like Latin America, like India. And we are now in the process of delivering data and content in local languages because we would like to engage those local consumers. We are constantly aware of the music ecosystem, and we want to connect with all the industry players, even though some of them are not our clients. So basically now we're trying to pair our IDs, like artist IDs, track IDs, with music platforms like Spotify and Beats and Bloom, so as to enable developers to work with those platforms and to use metadata from us. So we're trying to connect the dots. And also, we directly engage with music industry professionals. We try to network, we try to go to events, and actually listen to people and to what they want. And it's actually an advantage because we're able to cater to so many players because we get so many perspectives in terms of metadata, so then we're able to create a bigger picture and bring the pieces together. We just went to South by Southwest, So we took part in 2 hackathons there, and we gave a presentation. And on the right, we were in Texas. We were queuing for a barbecue, because once in Texas. So we met a guy that worked in Def Jam. So we had a chat about that. So we basically listen to people anywhere we go, and we're interested in everyone has to say. So that's about all. Guys, if you want to come and answer the questions, we're open for questions.
I've got 2 questions, if there is, and that's your lot, then tea and coffee awaits. So,
any questions? Don't get between people and their coffee.
There's a question about the service that you provide. Obviously, it's not for free. You must, this is information that you monetize.
It depends.
My question is that a lot of content that floats around on the internet is created by fans.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And personally, I've had information used and commercialized by companies. I'm not saying Decibel, but do you pay people to contribute? And if content is, or intellectual property is stolen from sources, how do you deal with that?
Okay, we do not like to steal because it's illegal, it's immoral, and possibly fattening. So, you know, one of the reasons that we're a fact-based service is because you cannot copyright a fact. So, for instance, Bach was born in 1685. That sentence I could possibly copyright, but if you use the data, that's something else. We have an editorial staff, and this is why we're doing original content, because you know, we could just as easily do the Wikipedia page, but that infringes on the Wikipedia people, because if you take their original intellectual material, it means that the rest of your database is open source. So, you know, we're very, 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 very careful not to do that, and just to make sure that, Robert, yes.
That is actually incorrect. There is no share-alike clause in Creative Commons.
Okay. Well, you know something? I think it would probably be cheating all the kind people who contributed to Wikipedia. Yeah. Nonetheless,
it feels wrong to take the content there, the articles, then sell them for money.
That's exactly what it's for. I just give it attribution, and they're totally happy with that.
Okay. Well, that's kind of nice to hear. You saved
Why
us a lot of trouble.
Why are you corrupting us? but to answer your question, we do pay the people. So the editorial team is comprised of employees, the research team is comprised of employees, so we do pay the people to look over the data or to do in-depth research for us.
Okay, but did we answer your question?
I understand the thing about facts, that some individuals, through their dogged efforts, have uncovered the facts.
Oh, yes. Okay, recently we acquired a treasure trove of repertoire information, and, you know, we made the contribution because they did the work, so you know they're entitled to be compensated. Yes. Other question? Ooh, okay. We've said it all. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, cheers now. So you'd be glad to know there is an ocean of tea and coffee that way. We will reconvene at 15:35 for something that has kept me awake for many nights. We are going to link up live across the Atlantic to Microsoft Research Labs in Boston, USA.